From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Federal criminal charges are expected today against pro-Trump extremists who stormed the U.S. Capitol building. Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf is urging the president to strongly condemn yesterday's violence. Instead, he presented the Medal of Freedom to three professional athletes. Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger is joining Democrats who say the 25th Amendment should be invoked to remove Trump from power. Joining us now is Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat from Connecticut. And Senator, I wouldn't normally start an interview with a senator this way, but how are you?
I'm pretty good. Yesterday was pretty harrowing, very, very unsettling, not only in the sense of fear for personal safety, but also, frankly, deep trepidation for our democracy. That mob assault, armed insurrection to the heart of our democracy, incited and instigated by the president, was really so abhorrent and so frightening in terms of where we go from here as a democracy.
After what happened earlier in the day yesterday, how important was it to you that the work of that joint session to certify the election results went forward later in the evening?
Very important question, and it was very significant to all of us that we go back to work, finish the job, and complete the counting and certifying of all the electoral votes. We were determined that we were going back and show the American people that mob violence, a riot, thugs, goons who assaulted the Capitol, broke into the Senate chamber, would not deter us from our work.
I know that you and others have been talking about the blame that the president deserves for inciting this mob, but what about those who are carrying his argument of a stolen election to Congress? Because even after the attack on the Capitol, eight senators, your colleagues in the Senate, continued to object to the Electoral College vote count. What sort of responsibility do those lawmakers need to face?
They have a responsibility to stand up and speak out, not in favor of objecting to the electoral count, which clearly was free of fraud, but against the president's fantasies and falsehoods that really fueled that mob. And their objection simply added weight to those fantasies and falsehoods that led the rioters to say the election was stolen, that it was rigged. This mob riot should really come as no surprise. It's of a piece with what we've seen over the past 4 years. And the president instigated and incited them, not just yesterday, but over a period of time, and his enablers, the Republicans who remained silent or who falsely supported his grievances through these opportunistic political stunts, also bear.
Will you be able to work with those senators? I'm just wondering sort of what damage has been done to relationships with other people in the Senate. Will you be able to face them and work with them?
We need to work together because we face a pandemic of immense magnitude. We've seen nothing like it in our lifetime. And, of course, an economic crisis that continues to cause hurt and pain in Connecticut and around the country. And I think that President Biden, and he will be President Biden on January 20th, there will be a peaceful transition of power, no thanks to Donald Trump, can lead us toward healing and coming together. We definitely need to come together. It will be difficult. Your question is well taken, but we need to work together for the sake of the American people.
You joined every Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee calling for the 25th Amendment to be invoked to remove the president from power. Is that just a symbolic move at this point with just 13 days left in his term?
I think it is more than symbolic to say, as I have said, that President Trump is a danger to our democracy, and I support any constitutional means or effort to remove him from office and prevent him from further damaging the American people. He really is mentally unfit. He has seemed unable to process his defeat, unable to accept the reality, and untethered to the fact So I think that it is time to consider seriously the 25th Amendment or impeachment, any constitutional means to remove him from office. But, of course, I'm going to be working first and foremost to prevent further violence and protect that peaceful transition of power on January 20th. That ultimately is the most likely solution here.
Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Many Americans are noting the remarkable difference in how these pro-Trump extremists were treated by police on Wednesday compared to how Black Lives Matter protesters have been treated by law enforcement. Ibram Kendi is an author and historian and founding director of Boston University's Center for Anti-Racist Research, and he joins us now for this conversation. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Ibram, you tweeted yesterday, "Just spoke to my 69-year-old mother. First thing she said, if these people would have been Black, then they all would be dead." What she was articulating is a stark contrast many people were able to see. How would you describe the impact this moment is having on Americans being able to see the difference?
Well, I think that is certainly the hope. You know, after a year where we may have had more demonstrations than any point in American history, and those demonstrations were, of course, against police violence and racism, and 93% of those demonstrations, according to one study, were peaceful. But then still, many of those demonstrators faced police violence, faced a massive military force. And by contrast, we did not see that yesterday, even though this mob attacked the sort of citadel of America.
You know, it really raises the question, who has the right to dissent in this country? I mean, who has the right to protest?
Precisely. And I think when you talk to Black folks, when you talk to other folks of color, when you talk to women, when you talk to low-income people, when you talk to many groups in this country, one of the fundamental things that they have said historically and still say today is they do not feel free, even free to speak out, even free to speak out against what is aggrieving them. Or they don't feel as free as particularly the types of folks who stormed the Capitol yesterday, because they see the contrast when they speak out and what happens to them. When we speak out and what happens to us.
We've heard a lot of Americans comparing what happened yesterday in our nation's capital to what happens in third world countries. And there is this argument that that is an elitist framing, that somehow Americans, despite what we might be seeing as a crumbling of our democracy, are above devolving into chaos. What are your thoughts on this?
It's ahistorical. And I mean, to read American history, to remember American history, is to remember coup attempt after coup attempt, whether political or economic. I'm thinking, of course, about, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma, or I'm thinking about all sorts of attempted or actual coups during the Reconstruction era, or even the Civil War itself. Or even in the last year, what happened at the U.S. Capitol has happened at state capitals. And as a result, particularly of people violently opposing shutdowns in their states as a result, you know, of COVID-19, or even plotting to assassinate sitting governors. I mean, this is America, and I think people need to recognize that this is not a third world country. And if a third world country, then essentially what they're saying is that America is a third world country, because we have to accept that this is historically happening and it still is in this country.
I have just a minute with you left, but do you see this chaos as possibly an encapsulation of progress up against the yearning for regression? I mean, is this a byproduct of what happens during great progress, or is this truly a devolvement of our democracy?
I think it's a fundamental clash. and I wrote about this recently in The Atlantic, that historically, America has had two forces, the force of justice and the force of injustice. And certainly when the force of justice have advanced, that force of justice has essentially sought to stop that advance, oftentimes violently. And Americans need to recognize that both forces are inherent, have historically existed within this country.
Ibram Kendi is an author and historian and founding director of the Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We want to take a look at the legal and constitutional questions raised by yesterday's insurrection at the Capitol. Noah Feldman is professor of law at Harvard University. He's on Skype. Professor, good to speak with you.
Pleasure to be here.
And people are throwing around a lot of terms in the aftermath of this insurrection. Sedition is one of them, and I'm going to ask if it applies to what we saw yesterday in just a moment. But first, if you could define that word for me.
Sedition is a technical term here that comes from a federal law. And that law defines sedition as conspiring to overthrow the government of the United States, essentially by force, or to hinder the execution of the laws of the United States by force, or to steal the property or take the property of the United States by force. And as you can hear from that definition, some bits of it could be twisted to fit the events that we saw. That said, this is a law that's only very rarely implemented, and an ordinary protester who breaks through a barrier and enters a federal building is not typically charged with sedition.
So what's the difference? I mean, tell me what you saw and what gets close to that definition that you gave.
It may be that some of the people who entered the building were trying to overthrow the government of the United States, but that's not obvious. What it looked like is that they were trying to interfere with the orderly operations of the government, and that's not exactly the same. There is a law of the United States that says how we should count the ballots, and the protesters were trying to interfere with that. So in that sense, they were opposing the authority of the United States. And the question then is, were they doing that by force? Well, there was some force used. Windows were broken. Some protesters were armed. But others were doing it in a manner that we would treat ordinarily as protest falling short of the use of force. So I would say in each of these instances, there's a view where you could say, this is absolutely sedition under the law. And another view where you would say, potentially it could be called sedition, but it may not be sedition in the technical term. I would be astonished if any of the protesters were actually charged with crimes of sedition. From the standpoint of hard statutory language, it would be very difficult to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the conduct that we observed counted as sedition under the law.
I see. All right, let's turn to President Trump. Yesterday, as we know, he spoke to his supporters just before they stormed the Capitol, and he repeated his false claims that the election was stolen. And then he said this.
We're going to walk down anyone you want, but I think right here we're going to walk down to the Capitol. And we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women. And we're probably not going to be cheering so much for some of them. Because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong.
The president also urged his supporters not to give up. He said, we're going to have to fight much harder. What did you hear there from a legal perspective? Did the president cross any lines?
You know, First Amendment law says that for something to count as incitement, it has to be directed to inciting imminent lawless action and be likely to incite or produce that action. I think the second prong was probably satisfied here because the president's words did, in fact, incite immediate lawless action. On the other hand, it's not at all clear that the president's words were, quote, directed towards imminent lawless action, because in that clip that you just played, he's not calling in specific terms for anything lawless. He's calling for a protest march on the Capitol, and that's perfectly lawful and constitutionally protected, in fact. Similarly, when the president spoke later and told his supporters to go home while telling them that he loved them and that the election was being stolen, he was pretty careful not to use words that directed imminent lawless action. Now, all that said, an observer could say that much like Mark Antony's famous speech in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, the words and their meaning were clear, even though the literal statement was not to riot or to break into the Capitol. But it's very hard to prove that in a court of law. So I would say that the president was skirting the very edge of what would legally be called incitement and would be prosecutable. Again, in the real world, I can't imagine a prosecutor actually bringing charges against the president for his words.
There are legal repercussions, and then there are political repercussions. We're hearing now from the Washington Post and other outlets that some administration officials have discussed invoking the 25th Amendment, which would involve the cabinet getting together and agreeing to remove the president from power. Just remind us quickly how that would work, and do you think that at this point it's likely it could come to that?
The 25th Amendment doesn't remove the president from office. It just temporarily puts his powers into the hands of the vice president. It takes first a majority of the members of the cabinet, which seems very unlikely to happen here, and then it takes two-thirds of both houses of Congress. Also would be a reach. The mere fact that it was being discussed does suggest that there was a moment where reasonable people thought that the president had just gone much, much, much too far and that he was not operating in a manner that was consistent with the safety of the nation.
And what about impeachment? Others are talking about that, including Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who says she's going to be drafting articles of impeachment against the president. How would that work? There's less than 2 weeks left in his term.
You could do it before the end of the presidency. And the way that would matter would be if, as one of the articles of impeachment, there was a call to ban Donald Trump from ever running for office again in the future. You have to have a separate vote on that, aside from impeachment, and that would have long-term consequences.
Could they do that after the president leaves office, when Democrats will have control of both the House and the Senate?
A lot of people would say that you couldn't impeach the president after he was already outside of office. That might look too much like what the Constitution prohibits, a so-called bill of attainder, which is a law that attaints someone for criminal conduct by virtue of not a trial, but of congressional action. Realistically, I don't think any of these things is going to happen. What's worth reminding ourselves of is there was a time to impeach the president when the House in fact impeached him, and there was a time to remove him when the Senate didn't remove him in early 2020, and that was the consequential impeachment. Let's remember that was for the president distorting the election in 2020 to try to stop Joe Biden from becoming president, more or less the same thing that he's just done. So, you know, I was there. I testified that he should be impeached and removed. I believe that was correct then, and we shouldn't forget that we had an opportunity to do that.
Noah Feldman, professor of law at Harvard University, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
We want to get an update now on the pandemic in China, a year after it started there. NPR's Emily Fang joins us from Beijing. And Emily, before we ask you about COVID-19 there, can you first tell us how China is responding to what happened at the U.S. Capitol yesterday? What is the government saying?
They haven't said that much, and it is normal for Chinese leaders to refrain from making direct comments about affairs like this in other countries, but China's foreign ministry and a number of Chinese state media outlets and social media accounts had a field day today comparing what they thought was a moment of hypocrisy in American foreign policy. They were comparing a break-in in Hong Kong of their legislative building in 2019 with what happened in our capital. And they criticized the fact that at the time, U.S. leaders applauded Hong Kong protesters for then protesting for democratic reforms in Hong Kong, which Beijing now governs, while calling the break-in at Capitol Hill violent and mob behavior. And in particular, they took umbrage with the fact that Nancy Pelosi had called peaceful protests in Hong Kong a beautiful sight. So today, dozens of Chinese state media accounts started tweeting videos showing side-by-side portraits of what was happening in Hong Kong in 2019 and the break-in at Capitol Hill, and asking, why doesn't the U.S. also call this a beautiful sight? Why are they decrying it as violence? And of course, the two are radically different. But Chinese media were really kind of in delight at the fact that the U.S. seemed to be falling apart politically today.
Well, we'll continue to follow this story, of course. But now let's turn to COVID-19 in China. How would you characterize the pandemic there as 2021 begins?
We're still not out of the woods yet. I've come on the show before and talked about how people are going to restaurants again, and they're going to clubs and taking vacations. They're traveling domestically, but of course no one can leave. But there are still outbreaks that are happening in China. And when that happens, an entire city will go into lockdown, seal itself off, and mass test all of its residents. unlucky people will get stuck, and you just have to pay attention to those travel advisories. But if you're in your own little bubble and there are no cases for the time being, life feels relatively normal.
You know, here in the U.S., there's a lot of criticism that the vaccination rollout is going too slowly. China has a mass vaccination program going on right now. Give us a sense of the scale of that program and how it's going.
It is massive. They're trying to vaccinate more than half of their citizens by the midpoint of this year. But keep in mind, China had a bit of a head start. They had already vaccinated about 4.5 million people even before any of their vaccines got market approval. They did this under emergency guidelines, and it was mostly state workers who got vaccinated with then experimental vaccines that hadn't yet gotten regulatory approval yet. China has four vaccine candidates that will likely get market approval. One of them is now on the market as of last month and is now being injected into the arms of tens of thousands of people a day. But it will still be slow going to vaccinate enough people, given that this is a country of more than 1 billion.
Mm-hmm. And then there's this news that the World Health Organization is trying to get a team of investigators into Wuhan, where the pandemic first started. Is China going to let them in?
I am not optimistic. China's defense is they're still negotiating on the specific itinerary and dates that the team were supposed to come and do their work in China. But they gave a very vague explanation that, quote, the origins of the coronavirus is a complex topic, so there need to be further arrangements made. And to this date, officials in China's foreign ministry have continued to dispute the fact that the coronavirus began in China.
Mm. NPR's Emily Fang in Beijing. Emily, thank you so much for this update.
Thank you, Tanya.
We want to take a look at some of the implications for Congress following yesterday's insurrection at the Capitol by pro-Trump extremists. Ron Elving is NPR senior editor and correspondent. He's a close watcher of Congress. He has been for years, and he joins us now from Washington. Hey, Ron.
Good to be with you.
Ron, before yesterday, most Republican lawmakers were supportive of the president on some level, along with his false claims that the election was stolen because people didn't want to upset his base. But going forward, what will the national perception of the president be, you think, both from his base and Republican lawmakers?
The Trump presidency is now in a state of collapse. He is still in the Oval Office, and his legal authorities remain, troubling as that is to many, for another dozen days. But I believe this was the end of the Trump phenomenon as we have known it. The end of the respect that some had given him, if only out of respect for his office. And that is a consequence of his own lack of respect for some of the responsibilities of his office. Now, Donald Trump was a businessman, but he came to politics largely as a reality TV star, as you remember. And he brought that particular media ethos to his campaign and to his 4 years in office. And yesterday, actual reality caught up to the act. And the very palpable consequences of his performance were finally felt by everyone.
Well, thinking about the implications for Congress, polls, though, show that there's very poor public opinion of Congress in general. But did something change yesterday when people saw these buildings attacked?
I spoke of reverence for the Capitol, and that has rarely extended to the Congress itself that meets there. People have made a living making fun of Congress for 200 years. Mark Twain, Will Rogers, countless late-night comedians in our time. But in the end, Congress is vulnerable and laughable because we sent them to Washington and they are us. They really do represent the best and the worst and the weirdest of who we are. That's their strength as well as their weakness, and it is their claim to legitimacy in making our laws. And late last night and early this morning, under the worst of circumstances, and they were truly freaked out. These people were really seriously scared. They got it together. They picked it up where they had been forced to leave off. And Vice President Pence gave a lovely brief speech and said, "Let's get back to work." And that's just what they did.
Democratic Congresswoman Cori Bush of Missouri has introduced this legislation to have them some them investigated and potentially removed. Speaking specifically about some of the folks that were against certifying the election, what's going to be the repercussions in Congress as it moves forward with both chambers to be controlled by Democrats?
You know, I mentioned there was a lot of fear last night, a great deal of anger as well, and many statements made in anger will get considerable attention in the media today and this weekend, I think, going forward. But Congress in the weeks ahead, especially after Inauguration Day, is going to have lots to do. It has to deal with the pandemic. It is getting worse. It is worse now than it has ever been. The economy is suffering from it and will suffer worse if Congress doesn't act and act fast. And health care and, yes, election reform. All those things are on the docket, all of which are going to require putting the anger aside.
Ron Elving, NPR senior editor and correspondent, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Here's what it sounded like yesterday inside the U.S. Capitol as a violent mob stormed the building. Colorado Public Radio reporter Caitlin Kim was there. She was the one who recorded that tape. And Caitlin, we spoke with you yesterday just as all of this was unfolding, but we didn't yet have that tape. What was it like to hear that warning blare through Congress?
It was shocking. You know, it's not, I never expected to hear that kind of announcement here at the U.S. Capitol building in America.
Yeah. You know, just in terms of the tone and the mood, I heard from the chief of staff of one member of Congress pretty late last night, who told me that she was still locked up in their offices and that at a certain point, people were starting to get hungry. What was it like for people to be on lockdown under such a tense condition for so long? And then you had to get back to work to confirm those electoral votes. What was that like?
It was a surreal moment. You know, you could hear rioters in the building. You could hear flashbangs go off, you know, and people were doing what they could to protect themselves, you know, dimming lights, locking doors, putting our phones on vibrate. But, you know, we're reporters. We were also trying to do our jobs. And that's what everyone was doing. And it kind of helped take your mind off of things, you know, but we were out there reporting what we could from where we were.
At what point were you able to get up and out and you know, start to move around the building and do your job?
It took a while. Capitol Police, you know, came and checked on us in about an hour after that sort of message went out. And they were basically telling us to stay put. But, you know, they would come and check on us periodically. And at one point they were like, all right, time to go. And they moved us all to another separate location, secure separate location. But, you know, it was... They did their best. I think everyone was trying to do their best as well and listening to what they were saying and not sort of trying to get out there and get into trouble. And yeah, it was surreal.
I spoke with two members of Congress today and you could just hear the emotion in their voice. I think it was a very tough, long night for them. What is it like today? I mean, what's the feeling like there inside the building?
You know, I came into the building today this morning and it's not as tense as it was last night. I think, you know, people were just like, we can't believe this happened. But, you know, the staff here, they're working, they're cleaning, they're making sure, you know, sweeping up glass, you know, cleaning all this debris and garbage left by rioters last night. People are getting back to the work that they have to do. And I think that's something that lawmakers were talking about, that, you know, Congress is not going to be intimidated and they're going to do their job.
Colorado Public Radio's Caitlin Kim, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Well, a lot of powerful words have been used to describe what happened yesterday. But was it a coup? Our next guest has been using that word to describe the president's behavior ever since he lost the election to Joe Biden in early November. And Zeynep Tüfekçi should know. She's lived through four coups in her native Turkey and warns that Americans need to focus on the actions that are leading the country down a dangerous path. Zeynep Tüfekçi joins us now, and she's a regular contributor to Atlantic Magazine. Zeynep, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, and you say that in Turkish there are many different words for a coup because there are so many different types and you have so much experience with them. So what did you see yesterday? Was it a coup?
It was an attempt to steal an election, and it may not technically be a coup. It may be a self-coup, or it may be an attempt to steal an election. But the reason we use the word coup is that people realize that just represents what's happening best, rather than maybe being the most technically correct term, in that there is a president who tried very hard, maybe not competently, but definitely tried very hard to steal an election. And yesterday, it resulted in the mob he incited storming the legislature where the election was being certified. So that is absolutely some sort of coup attempt.
Yeah. Well, and we've been hearing from people around the world who say, at the very least, this feels very familiar to us in our home governments. Compare this to what you've seen in Turkey. Did it feel familiar to you?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, when you see that picture of the insurrectionists, for the lack of a better word here again, sitting at the Senate and the House and, posing from the office of the Speaker of the House and basically yelling, "Trump won," that is intimately familiar. It is just not something unusual. In fact, that's the reason I wrote that article. I saw that in December. A lot of Americans were trying to argue over the best technical term, and the political scientists were weighing in with the correct, sort of the more pedantic approach. And I appreciate it. I'm an academic. There's some value in the precision there. But that shouldn't overshadow what was coming our way as I was writing what is being attempted. The president of the United States was attempting to steal the election by falsely asserting that he won it and trying to mobilize all the extra legal forces he could muster from his office to try to get them to overturn the election in his favor.
Yeah, and you were making the point then, just to be clear, that this was happening long before yesterday. And you can call it whatever you want, a coup or a self-coup or whatever, but in your experience, can a leader ever pull that off on his own? In other words, what role do you think fellow Republicans and the president's allies have in helping him get to this point?
Well, of course, the key thing here is that I think people are mistaking ridiculous with not serious, right? There's a lot of things that have been going on that are kind of ridiculous. The president tweets with all sorts of punctuation errors. The insurrections yesterday, some of them were wearing like hats with horns and, it looks ridiculous, but it's not unserious. And it's also important to realize that even after the mob disrupted the certification of the effort, the majority of the GOP caucus in the House, 138 representatives, voted to overthrow the results of the Pennsylvania election. I mean, even the Pennsylvania representative who was just elected with those votes voted to throw out the ones for the president. These are not normal hiccups of a transition. These are attempts to steal an election. There are a lot of ridiculous coup attempts around the world, too. A lot of them are ridiculous and fail the first time or the second time or the third time, and then they succeed. And yesterday, I have to say, the vote in the House and the Senate trying to throw out perfectly legitimate votes, that should scare us, because even armed men and women breaking into the Capitol did not alarm the Republican legislatures enough to say, okay, fine, this is it, we're stopping this.
I'll go back to your own words that you wrote in December when you said that what starts as a farce may end as a tragedy. And that feels so prophetic after what happened yesterday. So the question for me is, now what? Is this, a turning point when the country realizes the trouble that it's in? Or is it just the latest stop on what could be a long and dangerous road ahead?
It depends on how we react. A line has been crossed both by the mob attempting to stop this vote and storming the Capitol, and a line has been crossed by the senators and representatives who voted to throw out legitimate votes. So it's how we react to that line being crossed that will determine whether they'll try again. And there's no reason to assume the next time will be similarly ridiculous or incompetent, because this time was very serious, and next time it might be more competent. There may be more votes. The legislature was evenly divided almost between Republicans and Democrats, and the majority, 65%, voted to overthrow the election. I don't think people have connected that fact with the storming of the Capitol, and they should. This is a alarm for a potential five-alarm fire. Even if this transition goes through, there's a playbook that's happened now of how to steal an election and how to overturn it. And if we react to it by just sort of nitpicking the words, is it this, is it that, instead of focusing on the really important, crucial need to unite as a country and react, I think we'll see more. And I have to say, this is not a partisan problem at all.
A wake-up call for sure. Zeynep Tufekci, whose December article in The Atlantic says it's now time to start using the word coup to describe the president's attempts to overturn the election. Zeynep, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
NPR is calling what happened at the U.S. Capitol yesterday an insurrection. As we've heard earlier this hour, others argue that it could be called a coup. But it's clear that the violence was an attack on the country's democratic institutions and that President Trump fanned the flames. And for more on how to talk about this story, we're joined by NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Tanya.
Journalists have struggled to capture the enormity of events yesterday. You could say it started with a protest, then turned into a mob led by pro-Trump extremists. How did the media's coverage change as this violence escalated?
Well, I think you saw them reacting often with a little bit of a time lag. Inside NPR and other news organizations, you saw leadership sending out advisories. How are we going to characterize people? Are we still going to be calling them protesters? Well, they had been protesting, but it sure led to something that looked very more like a mob movement. And then, as you suggest, really something that was the sacking of the Capitol building, the Capitol structure where our legislature meets, one of the three major branches of government. And so you found news organizations trying to find ways to do that. At NPR, the word was used, an insurrection. You heard the presidential historian Michael Beschloss call it an attempted coup d'etat. And you heard that phrase from people like, I believe, Jake Tapper on CNN. So you saw people struggling to capture what people saw happening in front of them with their own eyes.
Sure. And those were questions we were actually asking as it was happening in real time. But knowing what we know now, what are the best ways to characterize the attack?
Well, take the word insurrectionist, which I think is accurate and fair. It's people engaging in a rebellion of sorts against government actions. It's not a word that we really use much in day-to-day conversation. It's a little hard for, I think, listeners to necessarily understand what that means. You use the word coup d'etat. You know, well, it's fair to say that this was an effort to disrupt the certification, the official sanction and approval of what had been a fair and free election found to be by members of both parties throughout all 50 states. And in that sense, it was a disruption of a democratic process goaded by the sitting president against an election that was affirming the win of his opponent. Maybe you can make that case. Academics and scholars and people who deal with this abroad would say, well, you really need military leaders or elite officials usually being able to command people to their leadership as being part of something you would call a coup. This might not technically fit, but I can certainly understand the justification for saying that in this case. I think that people are trying to calibrate their language. I think it's important not to be alarmist. It's certainly fair to call it mob, a riot. You could call it insurrection. I think it's fair to say that Congress was sacked by a mob goaded by the President of the United States. You don't necessarily need a technical definition to know what that signifies about an assault on democracy.
Mm-hmm. You know, the people that smashed those windows at the Capitol building. Even as that was happening, Trump's staunchest allies were assigning blame elsewhere, saying that it was the work of Antifa, for example, even though there's no evidence to support that. How has that played out on right-wing media?
Well, you saw that being raised by guests on Fox News and given it at least a seriousness of purpose on shows like Laura Ingraham's, Lou Dobbs. Even, former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin said to one of Fox's news anchors, Marsha McCallum, without really anything in the way of pushback. The Washington Times, which is a very conservative publication, posted a story claiming that there was evidence to show that a facial recognition company had been able to identify two Antifa leaders as being among those who had led folks. That story has been pulled back. An executive for the company involved says it was false from start to finish and appears to have been completely discredited. But it certainly was used to hearten those who attempt to initially people who might have minimized the seriousness of what was happening, then attempting to deflect responsibility for what was happening. But you have seen that consistently from certain kinds of opinion guests and hosts on Fox, as well as Newsmax and others.
You know, journalists are not the story. We try to keep ourselves out of the story. But journalists at the Capitol were themselves threatened. What did they face?
Well, I think you saw a lot of hostility. I think you saw a graffiti in the House of Representatives basically calling for the murder of journalists. You saw a number of folks with very viscerally anti-media slogans on their sweatshirts and hats. Outside on the Capitol grounds a bit earlier before the storming, when as the mob was gaining in anger, folks turned against essentially a camera crew for the Associated Press chanting anti-CNN slogans and destroying equipment. And you've had individual other reports of the degree to which reporters felt threatened. My understanding is that the Salt Lake Tribune has reported one of its reporters was also attacked by pro-Trump protesters inspired by the mob in Washington. They turned on him in protest at the state capitol in the state of Utah, an indication of what this kind of rhetoric can do.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. As always, thank you so much, David.
You bet.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.